The first time I realized I was being hunted, I was holding a lukewarm latte and a stack of color-corrected proofs for the Q3 skincare campaign. Julian didn't shout. He didn't touch me. He didn't even look up from his monitor. He just said, without a flicker of hesitation in his voice, that the brand strategy for the relaunch wasn't quite hitting the emotional notes he wanted, and that we should probably discuss it over dinner tonight at a place in Tribeca he'd been meaning to try. He called it a working session. He said I had a raw instinct that the senior team lacked, and he wanted to nurture that away from the noise of the open plan office. He said he saw a younger version of himself in my work ethic. I remember the exact temperature of the room in that moment. The way the air conditioning in our Manhattan loft office always seemed to bite at my ankles, and the way my heart didn't flutter with pride, but instead dropped into the pit of my stomach like a lead weight. I had been at the agency for exactly 6 months. It was my first real job after a string of internships that paid in experience and Metro cards. I was a junior creative associate, a title that sounded much more important than it was. In reality, I was the person who stayed until 9 p.m. to ensure the hex codes were consistent and the file names were perfect. Julian was the reason I took the job. He was a legend in the industry, the kind of creative director who won Lions at Cannes and gave TED Talks about the architecture of desire. He was charismatic, impeccably dressed, and possessed a level of professional gravity that made everyone in the room lean toward him. When he praised your work, it felt like being knighted. When he ignored you, the world went gray. The restaurant was the kind of place that didn't have a sign out front, just a heavy oak door and a sense of earned exclusivity. I arrived in my work clothes, clutching a leather-bound notebook and two pens, desperately trying to signal that this was a business meeting. I had spent 45 minutes in the office bathroom before leaving, trying to decide if my eyeliner looked too intentional or if my blazer made me look like I was trying too hard to be a grown-up. I settled on looking professional, which I hoped would act as a suit of armor. But when I walked in, Julian was already there, tucked into a corner booth that felt miles away from the nearest table. There was already a bottle of wine open. There wasn't a notebook in sight. He spent the first hour talking about his divorce. It was a practiced narrative, full of self-deprecation and a carefully curated brand of vulnerability. He talked about how lonely it was at the top, how hard it was to find people who truly understood the poetry of the cell. Every time I tried to steer the conversation back to the skincare campaign, he would smile, pour me more wine, and tell me to relax. He told me I was too tense, that I needed to learn how to inhabit my own talent. He reached across the table and placed his hand over mine to emphasize a point about creative liberation. His skin was dry and warm. I didn't pull my hand away. I sat there, calculating the cost of a scene. I thought about my rent, my student loans, and the three girls who had occupied my desk in the 18 months before I was hired. I started keeping the blue folder 3 days later. It's a slim, nondescript cardboard sleeve tucked under a pile of old tax documents in my bedside table. Inside it is a growing collection of evidence. I didn't know I was gathering until I had enough to call it a pattern. There is the printed email where he told me he'd booked a hotel suite for the off-site brainstorm in Montauk, just for the two of us. There is the screenshot of a text message sent at 1:14 a.m. that simply said, "I'm thinking about that look you gave me in the pitch today." There is a receipt for a silk scarf he left on my desk, with a note saying it matched my eyes, a gift I never opened and never wore. Each item in the folder felt like a betrayal of the career I thought I was building. I wanted to be known for my copy, for my ability to understand consumer psychology, for my grit. Instead, I was becoming an expert in the geography of Julian's whims. The office began to feel like a minefield. I learned to read the rhythm of his footsteps. If they were fast and heavy, he was in a creative fugue and everyone was safe. If they were slow and deliberate, he was looking for someone to focus on. Usually it was me. He would stand behind my chair, his hand resting on the back of my neck, guiding my cursor. The other women in the office looked away. We all did it. We practiced a form of collective blindness that felt like survival. I saw the way Sarah, the account executive, would suddenly find a reason to go to the kitchen whenever Julian lingered too long at my desk. I saw the way the interns watched me with a mix of pity and envy, thinking I was being fast-tracked for a promotion I didn't want. I couldn't admit to myself that I was scared. To admit fear was to admit that I was a victim, and I was too ambitious for that label. I told myself I was managing him. I told myself that this was just how the industry worked, a relic of a Mad Men era that hadn't quite faded in the boutique agencies of New York. I believed that if I was smart enough and fast enough, I could dance between the raindrops without getting wet. I thought I could take the mentorship and the opportunities he offered while politely declining the price tag he'd attached to them. It was a delusion built on the arrogance of being 24. The shift happened when I declined the Montauk trip. I did it over email, citing a family commitment I'd made up on the spot. I kept the tone light, professional, and firm. I hit send and felt a brief, flickering moment of triumph. I had set a boundary. I had protected myself. But when I walked into the office the next morning, the temperature had changed. Julian didn't look at me. My name was missing from the invite for the client presentation I had spent 3 weeks preparing for. When I asked him about it, he didn't raise his voice. He just looked through me and said that he felt I wasn't aligned with the vision of the project anymore. He said he needed someone with more commitment. The practical consequence of speaking up is immediate and visible. It's the loss of the big accounts. It's the way you're suddenly left off the lunch orders. It's the subtle, agonizing feeling of being erased from the room while you're still standing in it. But the practical consequence of staying silent is much worse. It's the slow erosion of your own reality. You start to wonder if you imagined the hand on your neck. You start to wonder if the midnight texts were just friendly. You become a ghost in your own life, documenting your own disappearance in a blue folder you're too afraid to use. I found the names of the other three girls on LinkedIn. It wasn't hard. They had all left the agency within a few months of each other, moving to smaller firms, or leaving the industry entirely. I reached out to one of them, a girl named Maya, who had been the rising star before I arrived. We met for coffee in a windowless shop in Midtown, where we wouldn't be recognized. She didn't need me to explain why I was calling. She just looked at me with a tired, knowing expression and told me about her own dinner in Tribeca. She told me about the HR meeting she'd had before she resigned. She told me that the HR director, a woman who spoke often about female empowerment in the workplace, had listened to her story, looked at her evidence, and then told her that Julian was essential to the agency's DNA. She was told that perhaps she wasn't a culture fit. I didn't believe her at first. I thought my evidence was better. I thought I was more valuable. I thought the world had changed enough that a blue folder with timestamps and printed emails actually meant something. So I made an appointment with HR. I wore my most professional suit. I brought the folder. I didn't cry. I laid out the facts, the unwanted dinners, the late night texts, the gifts, the retaliation after I refused the hotel suite. I spoke clearly, using the language I'd seen in the employee handbook. I talked about hostile work environments and quid pro quo harassment. The HR director, a woman named Diane, took notes on a yellow legal pad. She didn't look shocked. She didn't look angry. She looked like she was performing a routine audit of a broken machine. When I finished, she thanked me for my candor. She told me that the agency took these allegations very seriously. Then, she asked me if I had considered how a formal investigation might impact my reputation in such a small, tightly knit industry. She reminded me that Julian had many friends at the top of the major holding companies. She asked if I was sure I hadn't misinterpreted his creative passion for something else. She suggested that maybe I was feeling overwhelmed by the pressure of the Manhattan market. The buzzing of the fluorescent lights in that office felt like it was inside my skull. I looked at the blue folder on the desk between us. It looked small. It looked pathetic. It was just paper. Julian was a billable hour. Julian was a multi-million dollar contract. Julian was the DNA. I realized in that moment that HR doesn't exist to protect the employee. It exists to protect the institution from the employee. I was a liability to be managed, a fire to be contained before it reached the velvet curtains of the executive suite. I stayed for another month. I watched as they hired my replacement, a 23-year-old girl with a bright smile and a portfolio full of promise. I saw the way Julian looked at her during the Monday morning meeting. I saw the way he leaned over her shoulder to guide her cursor. I wanted to scream. I wanted to grab her by the shoulders and tell her to start her own blue folder. But I didn't. I was too busy trying to find a new job without a reference from the legend who was currently sabotaging my every lead. I learned that Julian didn't have to fire me. He just had to make the air too thin for me to breathe. The truth I cannot yet admit is that I still want his approval. Even now, months later, working at a boring B2B agency where the creative is dull and the boundaries are strictly enforced, a part of me misses the high of being Julian's favorite. I hate that about myself. I hate that the grooming worked so well that I find myself checking his Instagram to see who he's taking to dinner in Tribeca. I hate that I feel like I failed because I couldn't survive the dinner invitation trap. I feel like I wasn't tough enough to handle the reality of the business. I am 25 years old, and I have learned that the big girl job is often just a fancy stage for an old, ugly play. The trap isn't just the invitation itself, it's the infrastructure that supports it. It's the silent coworkers, the complicit HR departments, and the industry legends who know exactly how much a junior associate's silence is worth. I still have the blue folder. I haven't thrown it away. Sometimes I open it just to remind myself that I wasn't crazy. The ink on the receipts is fading, and the screenshots are starting to feel like they belong to a different person, but the facts remain. The warning I want to give is this. If your boss asks you to a dinner that feels like a date, it is a date. If the strategy session happens in a hotel suite, there is no strategy. And if you think the evidence you're gathering will save you, remember that the house always wins, because the house was built by men like Julian. They don't fire the legends. They just wait for the girls to voluntarily resign. I am the fourth girl in 2 years to leave that desk. I wonder who the fifth will be. I wonder if she's already sitting there, looking at the hex codes, waiting for the footsteps to slow down behind her chair. The cost of my silence was my career at that agency, but the cost of my speech was my career in that circle. I am working again, but I am different. I don't stay late. I don't look for mentors. I keep my head down and my files organized. I have learned that creative liberation is usually just a code word for something much darker. I have learned that the most important skill you can have in advertising isn't copywriting or design. It's the ability to recognize the trap before the door clicks shut. I left my notebook on the table in Tribeca that night. I never went back for it. I like to think of it as a small piece of evidence left at the scene of a crime, but in reality, it was just a waste of good leather. Julian probably threw it away before the dessert menus arrived. He doesn't remember the notebook. He doesn't remember the skincare campaign. He only remembers that I was the one who said no, and in his world, that is the only sin that cannot be forgiven. I am out now, but the air still feels a little bit thin.